I'm going to whisper some things to you now about Crunch chocolate bars. Because apparently this whispering thing is a thing that makes you feel things. It's saying something crunchy is coming in the candy wrapper language. Imagine your tongue hiking up those crispy, rocky ridges. Now, drum roll, please.
Wow, that's good. Crunchy, munchy chocolate doesn't whisper.
Turn up the fun with Crunch.
Hello, I'm Kellyanne Taylor, and this is the Radio Times podcast. Every week, I sit down with a celebrity guest from the world of TV or film to talk about their lives, both on and off screen. To my fellow TV enthusiasts, I hope you enjoy listening. This week, I am joined by the Scottish actor Martin Compston. Born and raised in Greenock, Scotland, he first made his name starring in the Ken Roach film Sweet 16, which won the Best Screenplay Award at the 2002 Cannes Film Festival. It was his role as Detective Sergeant Steve Arnott in Jed Mercurio's Line of Duty that made him a household name. In this episode, we talk about how that role changed his life, what it's like living in Vegas, and why he's doing less on-screen nudity. Plus, we chat about his latest travel log, Martin Compston's Norwegian Fling, and what it was like running with wolves. Martin Compston, welcome to the Radio Times podcast.
How you doing? Thanks for having me.
No worries. Look, we're going to go a little bit everywhere in this conversation. We're going to talk a little bit about TV, talk about your career, and then, of course, come on to your TV project, which you're working on at the moment. But kick us off first and foremost with, what is the view from your sofa? Talk me through your living room setup.
All right. I wasn't expecting that as a kickoff. Right now, well, in front of it would be my son's table full of toys. Because he's his little table in front of our couch for the mornings. So when you've got a 4-year-old, the house is just a riot. In front of that, we've got a big sort of, we've got a lovely kind of big, I don't know what you'd call it in the house, like an indentation or stuff. So you can not to go all Friends on you, but the entertainment unit goes in there with the big telly and stuff. Yeah, that's pretty much it. My wife loves, she's got a bit of a green finger, so there's flowers and plants and stuff hanging off the top of it and all that kind of thing. But yeah, that's pretty much our setup. I would say, though, that's because I'm at home here in Vegas. We're very lucky that we were able to split our time, because we have a home in Greenock where I'm from as well. And actually, the view from the couch there is overlooking the Clyde. And it's absolutely beautiful. Wow. That's probably my favourite spot to, because if you lie back at the right angle, you just see water as you look out, so it's as if you're floating. So that's probably that's my favourite spot to just kind of relax.
Wow. Yeah, goodness. Well, it's nice to have the mixture of both entertainment centre or view of the Clyde. I mean, can you ask for anything better? What have you enjoyed watching recently on TV?
You know what? I just literally just started Curb Your Enthusiasm. I know that's so far behind the times. But it's brilliant. It really, really is good. But I think I got quite obsessed by The Bear, I think, like everybody else, which was pretty sensational. You know, I can't kind of walk about the kitchen now and make my son's breakfast without saying yes, chef, and all that kind of carry on. I can get quite hard when because I've been lucky, I've been working and quite a lot recently, and I don't like watching things when I work because I can get quite obsessive, and then instead of actually thinking about the scene or what you're doing, you're thinking, I can't wait to go home to finish this.
So true. Or you find yourself late at night watching an episode when you know you've got an early start.
No, absolutely. You keep flying through things. So I think I'm going to start Masters of the Air. I'm going to start that. I know a couple of lads in that, and they're all very talented boys and stuff, so I'm excited to see that.
Who gets control of the remote in your household? And normally, I think when I interview people with young kids, it tends to be the children get their way.
Oh, for sure. it's whatever. I mean, there's a ton of Disney films, and I mean, all we get is Minions and Despicable Me. He's mad on Baby Boss at the minute, which is a bit kind of weirds me out, that film. But he, And we still try, but the problem is, like, when you're doing 6 o'clock, half six starts to get up and get ready and do that stuff, by the time I get to the end of the day, like, I'm in my bed by 9, 9:30. It's usually when I get away to work, I can get a bit of peace and quiet, and I can watch the odd thing, you know. But yeah, it really is. But I probably, my wife would say me, and I know, because she kind of controls most things in the house, to be fair to her. So I think she kind of, she knows when I'm, yeah. But we've been kind of trying to catch through all the sort of award films, obviously, because we missed a lot of them. So yeah, we've kind of been catching up on them on the couch when we get a chance.
If you had to choose a snack and drink of choice whilst watching telly, what would it be?
Oh, I like a glass of red wine when watching something. I do like a glass of Malbec when I'm watching something, and a good snack. I mean, I've never been much of a sweet tooth. I do love crisps.
Oh, me too. What flavour?
Again, it'd depend where you are. If I was back home, it'd be Beef McCoy's. And over here, there's a crisp plate called Ruffles, which are really good. Yeah, they're really good.
Okay. Right, I want to take it back in time. So you grew up in, I'm going to say it, I'm sorry if I butcher it, and you can correct me and I can go again. You grew up in Greenock?
Yeah, no, that's pretty good. Yeah, Greenock.
Thank you. In Greenock, yeah. In Scotland. Yeah. Yeah. What's your first ever TV memory?
Oh, wow. Probably the one that really stands out for me. I mean, I think a lot of people, because it was funny, because I actually ended up on that slot with Monica the Glen, but my mum loved like Bally Kay, and we always had like a Chinese on a Sunday night in Bally Kay, and I think it's that famous Kevin Bridges joke, but when you heard that theme tune, you knew it was school in the morning. But yeah, she loved Bally Kay, but I think the one that left the biggest impact on me was Cracker, and there's that... Ooh. That amazing scene between Robbie Coltrane and Bobby Carlyle, and it's the scene about the sort of the guy who's trying to avenge the sort of the Hillsborough tragedy. But it's just there's two heavyweights, titan of actors, sort of going toe to toe across the table. And I remember watching it, going, "What is this? Like, I want to be part of that." You know, So that was something that really, really stuck with me.
Was TV watching much of a family affair? Did you do it a lot together?
Yeah, I think we did. I mean, especially the time as I always remember watching TV would be New Year, you know, when you were wee, because that's what you'd be in the house. Now you're always out and about, but it would be in and watching all the sort of New Year specials and all the like the sketch shows and all that kind of thing. My dad, the biggest thing I'd loved Only Fools and Horses at Christmas. That was always a big thing for us, watching. And it still is. Whenever I'm home, we always stick on Only Fools at Christmas and watch that. That was a big thing.
When do you first start getting the inkling that you want to be on screen? And did that feel like a plausible career path? I'm always interested because to me it seems like an industry that is untouchable.
Yeah, I think that's changing a bit. I think, you know, just with technology and, you know, people making their own TikTok films or whatever that be, and it's becoming more accessible. But no, for sure, when I was as young, it didn't seem like a plausible career. You know, I think to some extent, like most kids kind of want to be in movies, you know, it's just, I mean, we are big kids. It's just playing make-believe, you know, you're just playing cops and robbers and getting paid for it. So you just sort of, there's that element of you, but I never took it serious. I think the big thing that changed for me is I went on a kind of a double date with my mate when we were like 15, and we saw by mistake, My Name is Joe, which was a Ken Loach movie. And it was the first time I saw on the big screen people who spoke like me. And I didn't know, like, I recognised these characters, you know, they could be people from my town. And I went, I didn't know we could be on a big screen. And then just by chance, Ken Loach was casting a movie the following year in my town. And when just, you know, everything just sort of aligned for me in that period, it was, you know, I was very, very lucky that all that kind of happened at the same time. If I never saw that film then, I possibly never went to an audition. And if he wasn't holding auditions in my town, I probably wouldn't be an actor, you know. So I'm incredibly lucky that it just all fell into place for me.
It was an open audition, wasn't it? You were still at school. You were so young. Do you think that's also perhaps sometimes the naivety of youth, being able to walk in and think, like, I'll just give it a go?
Oh, for sure. So I auditioned at my school. The big thing is a close friend of mine, Gary Harkins, who became a professional footballer. Gary's dad, Joe, was our assistant head, and we all knew each other, because we were friends. But he was also our school football coach, and he said, "Look, there's this casting brief going around. They're looking for this certain type of kid," and he says, "And I think it's you." He said, "You should go for this audition," and I was like, "I don't know. Like, all my lads, all my pals will slag me." And he made like a few of us from the school football team go together. And that was great. I'll be forever thankful for him for doing that to me. And then, I just had a couple of additions. And I think you're right, though. Was that kind of fearlessness? I think in some ways I'm still trying to get back to that as an actor. Like, I wish I had the experience I have now with the fearlessness I had when I was 17, because it was all about the scene. You didn't take anything else into consideration, whether it be how big somebody's trailer, what's your turnaround, who's got the private car, all that kind of carry on. You just wanted to act, and nothing got in the way of that. And I think if I thought of the enormity of it, like if I knew the film was going to go to the Cannes Film Festival and all those kind of things, then I might have panicked. But I really just thought that I'm going to go give this as best a shot I can and finish it. But I felt very comfortable on set on day one.
Yeah.
I didn't feel out of place. And again, I think that's testament of just how good a director Ken Loach and his producer Rebecca and his writer Paul are. They just make you feel at ease, and they make you feel wanted, and they make you feel confident. And like, all my suggestions at 17 for somebody who had never been on a set before were listened to and taken on. And that just shows you why they're, the greats that what they are. So yeah, again, I'm very aware of how lucky I was to meet them when I did.
Yeah, and that opportunity must have opened doors for you. In episode 6 of your Norwegian fling, you do say, when you're talking to a singer in Norway, you say that actually after that opportunity you did have to move to London because that's where the opportunities were, or you felt that that's where your career had to move. Can we talk a little bit about that? Did that feel like the only way to really make a career, or do you think you could have stayed in Scotland and have made a name?
You could stay in Scotland. Now, I know everybody doesn't have this opportunity, but I do think if you do have the chance to get out and experience different cultures, whether that be London, Paris, Madrid, whatever, I really would encourage anybody who gets that opportunity to go and do it. It's a fabulous thing for a young person to do, whatever walk of life you're in. But for us at that time now, most auditions now are on tape, at least the first couple of rounds. Anyway, so you can be pretty much anywhere as long as you've got a phone and film it. But when I was younger, it would be literally like, we've got an audition, you need to be in Paddington at 3 o'clock. Now, obviously, if you're living in Greenock, you can't do that. So you really did feel like London, or even at that time, LA was the centre of everything. You had to be there. But I mean, when I was coming through, pilot season was a huge thing. And nobody ever kind of foresaw the end of that, and that's kind of finished now. The world's sort of changed, but I loved my time in London, just in general, just meeting new people, different cultures, big city. It was great fun, but I think once you get to a certain point, you kind of go like, I've done my time, I want to go home.
You had been in work pretty much continuously, but it was Line of Duty and, of course, Anti-Cooperation Unit Detective Inspector Steve Arnott that really made you a household name. Did you anticipate that popping off? Jeb Mercurio was my second episode of this podcast. So
really?
I feel like listeners can go back and enjoy that one too.
No, like, because it's funny, because when you're going back to Sweet 16, it was a big start, but I felt like that was a weight around my neck for a long time, because the film kind of did that well. But then a lot of people kind of thought I was that kid, I had related to it very well. And, and it was filmed in my hometown, and it was a phenomenal part for to make it. But that kid was not me, So I think Monica the Glen was a fabulous grounding for me, getting on that, because I didn't get tons of parts after it. But that was really like my drama school going and, hitting your mark, different directors, working with legends like Tom Baker and Susan Hampshire and all these kind of people. But then, Line of Duty comes along. And again, I probably owe my career to two people, and it would be Ken Loach and Jed Mercurio. I didn't think anybody would ever trust me to be the lead on a sort of BBC, you know, sort of network show. But I think when you start to see the cast he was building with Vicky and Lenny, you know, I kind of felt like, oh, that's kind of people. And a great friend of mine, Craig Parkinson, I was like, these are all kind of people, you know, I've worked with these kind of people or been in similar jobs as them. You know, I can really relate to them. So I don't think any of us had any idea like just what it would become. And especially I think me, Vicky and Adie didn't realise what a team we would become. I mean, the two of them are two of my best friends. I mean, we speak pretty much daily, or WhatsApp groups, you know. So I had no idea just how big it would become, but I think it's all just testament to Jed's writing. You know, it's just every series, and I suppose this is the big question about whether we'd do another one, because every year it has got bigger every year, and just the numbers it did the last series were insane.
Yeah, 15 million.
It was really overwhelming. I had to... And I thought last series, I thought there was, I think it was especially, there's a run in the last series, I think it's Ep 3, 4, 5, which are my favourite of all time, which Jed have written throughout the whole series. You know, there's the sniper, the van pop, and Vicky on the run, all that kind of thing. I think it was just, and it's incredible that he's still writing that sort of high-octane stuff after, I mean, we've probably been on it by that point by nearly 10 years. But I remember the last episode coming on and all the guys, we'd kind of got like on like a FaceTime together, and I was like, I need to go a walk. I was filming in Edinburgh in time. I think we were just coming. It was the sort of like the COVID rules were just getting relaxed. And I went a walk up to Edinburgh Castle, and I remember just thinking the streets were empty, and it was a weird feeling going, everybody's in watching this. It just felt like mammoth pressure, and almost became kind of too big and took a life of its own. But we're really lucky that we've kind of got each other, you know, me, Vicky, Jed and Adia. Like, we all kind of keep each other grounded and check in on each other. And we started doing that during the last series, like every week just checking in, because it just, I mean, I really appreciate that at that point, sort of the media sort of attention around it and stuff, but it can become a bit much, and it's a weird thing where you're really excited for it to come out and everybody to see it. And then when you get to about Ep 3, 4, you're like, oh, I can't wait for this to be done. Because they'll move on to the next thing. That's the nature of that kind of thing. It's nature of entertainment. Then the next big show will come out and they'll all be on to that. But it's just, it's a hard thing to, because it's not to complain about it, because you love the attention the show gets. You really appreciate that people coming up with their own theories and having their opinions. I love all that. I really, really do. But it's just the fever pitch that came to the last one. It was a lot.
And it was lockdown, which I think probably makes everything even worse and more amplified. Yeah. I had Sophie Rundle on the podcast, also not that long ago, who you co-starred with.
Sophie's brilliant, isn't she?
Yeah. Oh my gosh, what a fabulous conversationist. She's so intelligent. Yeah. And we had a really interesting conversation about how nudity and filming intimate scenes on screen had changed. And it was really interesting because I was having a conversation recently with a friend of mine, because I'm rewatching Game of Thrones. Mm-hmm. And when I started watching it, I was still maybe like late school years, and my parents were really shocked at how normalized it was for me. And when I was watching it, I was completely normalized to it. I didn't think anything of it. Now as an adult watching back, I'm thinking, do you know what? Actually, there are parts of this that do make me feel uncomfortable, because it does just feel gratuitous. It doesn't feel necessary to the plot. I wondered if actually, as an actor, if you could explain to me how it feels now that you have such a good body of work behind you. Do you feel more able to say...
I thought you were just
going to say
a good body.
I would never objectify you like that, but oh my gosh, this is going to be a meme, isn't it?
Yeah.
Anyway, of course you have that too, but now you have such a strong body of work behind you. If that's given you maybe more sway in the field?
No, absolutely. I'm lucky I've kind of got myself in a position now where I can have those conversations. But I think a huge thing that's changed is intimacy coordinators, which have been a fabulous addition to sets. You know, they're basically just like stunt coordinators for sort of love scenes or nudity scenes and stuff. And it's something that now we're thinking back, they should have been in a lot a lot earlier, because they take a lot of the pressure off the actor, because they're a sort of buffer between most directors. I say 99% of them are like very understanding and stuff. But, you know, there are probably, as I say, there are probably situations where it is a bit gratuitous and it's sort of done for reasons other than furthering the story. Now, I also feel a bit like I've done my time. You know, when I was younger, I've done Full Frontal. I've had my arse out loads of times. And, you know, you do get sent it on social media. And I find it bizarre because I'm like, what do you want me to send back here, mate? Like, what do you want me to say? Like, oh, nice one. And it's, so you kind of, I think as well, being a father now, you do think a little bit like, right, you've got to start being a bit more careful. Now, if it was for the story and it was essential to the story, yeah, I'd be up for it, you know? But it would need to be a conversation that was had, and there'd need to be a lot of trust between yourself and the director. But you do worry what you're saying, like where there are people who are just starting out who maybe don't feel that they don't have as strong a voice on set. Maybe they can be put in uncomfortable positions. But I hope that the introduction of intimacy coordinators has really made a massive difference to that, as I said, because now you just tell them what you're comfortable with and they go and speak to the director and the producers, and it doesn't come on to you when... Because I've had before, I did have a director go one time, well, just do this, I just want to see this. And I was like, well, you don't need it. And I remember it becoming a bit of an awkward atmosphere for a second. And, you know, and I was strong enough to just kind of do my thing. It wasn't the end of the world, but it's nice to have somebody between you for those conversations, because then they take all the kind of responsibility for that, and it doesn't make you feel awkward around people. You just go, right, well, that's what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is so, so important. And I think, like you say, it creates a dynamic where everyone can feel safe, which is, at the end of the day, the bare minimum when you're going to work is that you should feel safe and secure. Look, let's talk about Martin Compson's Norwegian Fling, which I loved. Nice. My favourite moment, or my highlight from the series, was you meeting the wolf. It's like you're meeting... a spirit animal. It's like this beautiful connection, and everyone leaves the ring, including your cameraman. And
you're just there. The big man bolted. He left me. He left me hanging. And he's a big lad, Tom, as well.
When you're an actor and you're used to seeing yourself on screen as a character, is it quite strange to just be Martin on screen?
It can be. You know, I'm lucky that I've done quite well with acting, but also, you know, I'm very aware that that's what I am. I'm an actor because it's been really kind, but I mean, I've been offered, I think, every reality show. I've been offered to present reality shows, and it's just, I'm not a TV presenter. You know, this idea began with me and my pal Phil, because Phil's a fluent Gaelic speaker, and we were like, we should do something about Gaelic, because I was starting to learn it and do that. And then it just sort of, we met our friend David at Tern, and it just sort of escalated. Like, let's make something bigger about Scotland and encompass all what it means to be Scottish in the modern age. And then we just had a blast. We just had a really good time, and it kind of morphed into this travel show. And then we went, well, do you want to go again? And I don't know who came up with Norway, but it was brilliant, because it was not... it's a strange thing as well to think. It never really comes up, but it's right across the water from us. You know, it's right there. It's sort of pretty much our nearest neighbours. And but when you get this list of stuff at the start, like, look, this is what we're thinking about doing, all that stuff. The wolves was one that I circled right away. That was my massive... That's what I was really, really looking forward to, because I'm aware that's not an everyday thing. Like, it's very rare you're going to get that opportunity. And I'm on this kind of weird... maybe it's a midlife crisis at the minute. It's my 40th later this year. But I've been doing trike lessons, like those three-wheel motorbikes.
Very nice.
And there was the wee woman who's been teaching me, she's great, and she said this thing of, which was great. She says, look, a green light is not a force field. Just because it's green and you go, some other idiot might hit you from the other side. So always be aware. And I was thinking that with the wolves in acting, because you kind of just go, I've kind of got a mad sense of security when somebody calls, because I've done stunts before it went wrong, but when somebody calls action and cut, I just kind of think, yeah, this will be fine. Like, if they've said it's fine. And it's the same with the wolves. When the guy was like, look, if you do this, you do this, you do this, you'll be fine. So I just kind of, that stuff doesn't really, I don't really hold any fear to it.
Yeah, you look at complete peace.
Because I think if you listen to the experts on these things, they know what they're doing, you know, and as long as you follow what they say, you're usually going to be all right. And I think that's why me and Phil work so well together, is he likes his fine dining. He likes his Scandi pop stars, you know, and I like running about with wolves and getting ducked underwater and all that kind of stuff. So, and Phil's just, you know, he's one of life's great guys, you know.
Yeah.
He's just a lot of fun to be around. He kind of draws people into him. Like, kind of one of my favourite moments of the whole trip was we stopped in the middle of nowhere sort of for, like, it sounds obvious to say, but a travelling show, there's a lot of travelling.
Yeah.
So even when you're not filming, it's sort of like, right, we've got a 6-hour drive to the next place. So it's quite exhausting, and we pulled up at this place and it was Eurovision that night, and Phil's, that's his nirvana, you know. And we're in the middle of nowhere, and we pulled up at this, what I could only explain to be like a Sainsbury's, a Tesco Metro, like it was nothing much there. And when we got to the place, he was like, where's the room showing the Eurovision? And it was just like this sort of wee kind of dingy room, and he went, right, all you guys go have dinner. And then we all had dinner, and then by the time we got back, this room is decked out in flags and party hats and champagne and cocktails and hats and all these fake toys. And then it wasn't just us. Everybody else from the rest of the hotel, all the kids and stuff, all kind of started gravitating towards this room.
Aww.
And it was this lovely moment. And, of course, Phil's just at the middle orchestrating it all. And that sort of just summed him up perfectly for me. You know, he's got a massive, massive heart. And, yeah, he's just great fun to be around.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it does feel, although sometimes I think when I watch Travelogue, wow, this is just an excuse to get to do all of these incredible things. But I do think that this is like a real ode to male friendship. It's like such a beautiful relationship you two have, singing in the car, like the humour of you two. There's that hot tub scene where you see this real like human side to you. Not that you're not human all the yeah. time, but you know, when someone's a celebrity or a famous actor, you don't always necessarily see the humanity of them. And then you two just having a drink, a
glass of champagne.
it's so good. But also, although this is all about Norway, there are constant references to Scotland, and
yes,
you're obviously so proud, and it's so nice to see of where you come from. Do you ever get homesick? And also, as you've got older, do you feel that pull even more of your roots and where you're from?
100%, but I said I'm lucky I have my home there. I spend most of my time there, you know, all my works. We are very lucky to have this, like my wife at the moment's probably, her job is more glamorous than me. She's away throwing the Grammys party, and she's just back from throwing Wyclef Jean's party in New York, and then she'll be on to a Super Bowl party. I mean, it's hard work. She's the one clearly
doing it.
But when I'm here, it's like it's kind of when I'm back, we're in Vegas, my wife's on the road, so I'm just at home being a dad. And then I think I leave in 10 days, and that'll be me gone for the next 4 months in Scotland, you know, and then the family will come join me. It's just when my job is so intense when I'm at home, like I leave, you're leaving at 5-6 in the morning, you're back at 8-9 at night, 5-6 nights a week. So I'd rather, you know, it's better for my wife to be here with the support of her family around her, you know. But no, I spend most of my time at home. I think you do appreciate, as you say, Joe, just what the country means to you. And I do, as much as I can, try and promote it. And as I'm getting older in my career, I'm very lucky that I'm getting to be the other side of the camera and producing a bit of stuff. And there's a lot of Scottish stories that I want to tell and also bring work to Scotland, you know? So yeah, I do. But also, again, I think that's the benefit of having had the ability to travel the world, you know, to have lived in London, to have lived in LA, to have lived in Vegas. You know, I do appreciate home more, but I can understand that not everybody can do that. But I do think if you have the opportunity, get out and see a bit of the world, for sure.
Okay, and just to finish up, you obviously are driving a lot on this. There's a lot of great music. If there was a soundtrack to your life, one song, what would it be?
Wow. Probably, I would either go, it would be Arctic Monkeys, Certain Romance, or Jerry Cinnamon, Canter.
Okay, well, there you go. Listen, Martin, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on the Radio Times podcast.
No problem. Thank you, Kellyanne.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Radio Times podcast, please do listen to my conversation with the writer behind Line of Duty, Jed Mercurio. Or you might enjoy my interview with David Tennant. Both episodes can be found by scrolling back through the Radio Times podcast feed. Thank you for listening to the Radio Times podcast with me, your host, Kellyanne Taylor. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please do follow, rate and review wherever you get your podcast from. It helps other TV and film lovers find us. Until next Tuesday, happy viewing.